This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon, and welcome once again to another of the talks hosted by the Friends of the National Museum. This afternoon, we're privileged to hear Senior Curator Margot Neal. Margot has just returned from Rome, assisting with a new exhibition of Aboriginal artworks sent from Catholic missions in the north and west of Australia to the Vatican, to coincide with the canonisation of Mary MacKillop. And Margot will talk about that exhibition. It opened on the 15th of October last. Now, Margot has a CV which I find quite astounding. It goes for several pages. I've distilled it to a few paragraphs, but I think it's worthwhile just going through some of her achievements. Margot is a senior research fellow at the Centre for Historical Research here in the museum, and she's a senior curator and principal advisor on Indigenous matters at the National Museum. She joined the museum in 2000 and was inaugural director of our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander program. Margot has previously worked with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Island art in the National Gallery of Australia, the Art Gallery of New South Wales, and the Queensland Art Gallery. She's lived and worked in Arnhem Land in the 1970s and in Christmas Island in the 1980s. Margot is also an adjunct professor in the history program of the Australian Centre for Indigenous History at the ANU and has been involved in numerous interdisciplinary projects, including as co-recipient of seven Australian Research Council grants in collaboration with the ANU and Monash University. Margot is the author, co-author or editor of 10 books on topics including the history of Christmas Island artists such as Emily Kane Kanawari and Lynn Onus, and most notably as co-author to the Oxford Companion to Aboriginal Art and Culture. Margot has been appointed by successive governments to various advisory and judging panels, which I won't enumerate. Margot's recent international exhibition on Emily Kane Kanawari in Japan won the Manning Clark House National Cultural Group Award 2008 for the National Museum of Australia. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Margot Neal.
Welcome, everybody. This is the right place to be on a wet day. One of the things that didn't happen, that were to happen, was you were to get a special abstract which was going to whip you up into a Da Vinci Code kind of drama. So I'm going to read you a little bit of what you didn't get, right? Because that'll plug you into the beginning of the next bit. A little bit of it. So I said, first of all, I want to acknowledge the traditional custodians, Ngambri and Ngunnawal peoples, and also to thank friends for giving me this opportunity to speak here today, and for you, Mob, for coming out. I thought it might be somewhat reduced, and it may be. So I've got the World Associate, I've called it A Mystery Revealed. The museum uncovers Australian treasures in the Vatican vaults. The world associates the treasures of the Vatican with the works of Michelangelo, Botticelli, Leonardo da Vinci, or ancient Roman tablets, but not generally Australian Aboriginal material. Who would have thought that amongst the treasures lying in the vaults of the Vatican are century-old Aboriginal objects? How did they get there? Who knew they were there? What's being done about it? Well, enter the National Museum of Australia. And how did one of the oldest and most visited museums in the world, with millions of visitors a year, get involved with one of the youngest museums in the world and one from the Antipodes to boot? Well, you know, the answers to these questions may have some affinity with the Da Vinci Codes or Dan Brown's Vatican-based Angels and Demons. And if you hadn't cracked the code by today, which you won't, of course, you didn't get this, part of the mystery, either the world would have been blown up by an antimatter bomb and four cardinals will have been murdered, or Opus Dei will have taken over the world. For the final clue may be, in fact, entombed in your coffee mug, awaiting its discovery at 1500 hours in the Friends Lounge. Well, clearly none of that happened. So just moving right along. Now, how many of you have read... Dan Brown's Angels and Demons. Yeah, so you'll know what I mean by Opus Dei and Antimatter. You don't have to know it to get the sense. Now, this story is played out over many sites. There's the Vatican, the NMA, and at the Vatican, those of you who know Rome can see where the... I can use this for pointer, can't I? Can see where the Vatican City is in relation to the rest of Rome. And this is where the museums are within the Vatican. And for those who read Dan Brown, the helipad's right over here somewhere. And there's St. Peter's Piazza. So it occupies quite a significant amount. And, of course, there's the Vatican Museums, and this is me trottling off to work every day, quite different from our red, glitzy tunnel. And I'm just giving you the atmosphere, if you like, of, you know, the great trek in, up the stairs, long passageways, up elevators. Oh, that was entombed with having a rest on the way. And how's this for a scene to be chatting to your colleagues along every other day? Now, New Norcia is another site on this mystery trail that we're about to undertake. And that's where... I probably won't tell you about it. I'll wait till we get it. So that's where these objects... These are the multiple sites that are part of the story of where these objects have been. The Tiwi Islands... the Lateran Palace in Rome. They had a short residency there. Similarly, at the Palace San Callisto in Trastevere, is that right? And the Propaganda Fidei in Rome, where the documentation is still stored and not fully retrievable yet. Now, some of the characters in the plot are Father Mappelli, who's this man here, who is the director of the Vatican Ethnological Museum, Catherine Agner, who added sort of a broker between the two, and some of his staff. And here he is infiltrating our apartment and acting suspiciously and pretending to be reading up on contemporary Aboriginal art. Well, that's what the cover says, but who knows what's inside? Maybe nothing. Here's a cluster of other characters in the plot, of this cluster of white trench-coated restorers, as they call themselves, and they're sort of spying on all our movements and keeping notes assiduously as they do. This one's pretending to be an object but didn't work in a case. And lurking in the high walls and the crevices, you'll find characters flitting hither and thither. And there's a bit of secret men's business on the sideline with Tim Fisher and Father Mappelli, and you see women are not included here. But we soon sorted that out. Down she comes, intrudes herself until she's fully included. You know what men are like sometimes. And, of course, this is Mappelli's henchwomen. Nadia on my left and your left, and Paolo on the right. And there's that famous spiral staircase. Of course, he's a real cheeky character. That's me, drinking for a water spout. And here I've been caught by the paparazzi, you know, in the dark of night, suspiciously taking of the sacred waters. And, of course, Pope Pius the 11th had something to do with it, and we'll find out. And Pope John Paul II... who delivered that rather momentous speech in Alice Springs, I think, in about 1986, and he adorns one side of the entry into the into the gallery. The koala's a bit twee, but they love it. And, of course, Father Mappelli with, but it's not about Father, this is about the current Pope, Benedictine the 16th, who also had some interesting things to say about Aboriginal elders. And other characters, of course, are not as obvious but are lurking on the walls as Raphael. So let's just see what all the plotting... Oh, sorry. I'll just go back there. So we can just see what all the plotting and planning was all about. Now, all the objects that you'll see were cleared for exhibition by communities, and there were no sacred material that shouldn't have been displayed, nor human remains. Now, as I sort of said earlier, the Vatican is associated mainly with people like Raphael and Roman tablets, in fact, and Leonardo, Michelangelo, as we know. So I keep hitting that. And but as I said before, the fact that this is all, they are co-fellows with Aboriginal work is of particular interest. So museums, I'll just go back a bit to a general statement here about how museums in the 21st century can no longer ignore the Indigenous peoples and their rights and cultural responsibility to their objects. So how do museums discharge their responsibilities to us as Indigenous people, our histories, our values, and our voices within the dominant culture's sort of knowledge system and collecting practices? How do Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people previously captive to the anthropological gaze and unequal power relations not only interrogate the histories that define them as other and lesser, but also how do we regain our voice and agency over cultural objects that reside in collections around the world? This is a perfect case study, the Vatican's ethnological collection. Under the new directorship of this energetic young and visionary priest, Father Mappelli, the Vatican Ethnological Museum has actually set a new course towards acknowledging their responsibility to the cultural owners of this 100-year-old material, Australian material, by exploring ways in which they can give value back to contemporary Indigenous communities and recognising that while this collection is in the custody of the Vatican, it remains the cultural legacy of Indigenous people. By inviting me as an Indigenous curator to assess and display the collection, the director, Father Mappelli, has started the cultural reconnection process and breathing life back into the objects as he describes it. Secondly, as a representative of the Vatican, he has made the effort on our invitation to visit the source communities of this collection in remote areas at the top end of Australia. It's the first of a number of journeys back, and there are other plans in the mix. Tiwi, Kalumburu community, and here he is playing Crocodile Dundee. And when I showed this image at the forum for the canonisation, well, for this opening, but part of the canonisation, evidently the cardinals weren't very impressed. And he got called out and ticked off for not wearing his proper gear and showing his legs. That was very funny, so, you know, a bit humourless, some of them. So these steps that were taken by the Vatican are quite remarkable, really, given that other museums in the world have yet to do this with the same commitment and tenacity. This community connection is the first step. The days of working with Indigenous collections and not communities are well and truly over. It was in this arts centre in the Tiwi Islands that he found a little bit of a surprise that was somewhat familiar to him. And this is the arts centre of the Tiwi Islands that is actually modelled on the barrel vaults of the Vatican. It surprised me too, I have to admit. Now, the question that's most often asked, of course, is how did the collection get to the Vatican? Well, in the 1920s, Indigenous Catholics from around the world responded to a call from Pope Pius XI, thus his appearance, inviting them to send objects that they thought best represented their culture and their spirituality to the Vatican for collection to be used in an exhibition he was mounting in 1925. Now, of course, material was sent from missions in Africa, Asia, the Americas, and Oceania, of course, which included 300 objects from the northern and western parts of Australia. The result was an arresting spectacle of over 100,000 pieces displayed across 24 rooms within the Vatican. After the exhibition, 40,000 pieces were retained, which formed the core of what became known as the museum's missionary ethnological collection. And today it has been built up to back to 100,000 objects. Well, we've already answered that. Oh, not entirely. So these objects were therefore created and donated by Aboriginal Catholics for their papa in Rome and are therefore invested with a strong devotional dimension. It is evident in the quality of the workmanship, and some works reveal as well an intriguing personal contribution which are unique to this collection. So unlike many, and you would imagine that this was from the 1970s, the tourist art, no, 1920s. Unlike many collections of this period, these works were not collected by ethnologists motivated by a salvage mentality, a belief that the culture was dying out, but rather as the signs of a thriving and dynamic culture. They were valued for their significant spiritual, artistic and ceremonial qualities. As I said before, therefore, notably, there are no human remains, most unlike that period, as we'll see, as I said, we'll see in collections of the period, or the secret sacred material that was not intended to be displayed by their makers. When I was asked to curate the collection, be a spokesperson for it, I agreed to do so because of its, you know, a number of reasons, but I certainly was more encouraged the fact that it did not have these tainted origins, and because Father Mappelli and I actually wanted the same thing. What we wanted to do was to avoid the old ethnological approach, which would display them as disembodied objects divorced from their makers and culture, sort of mummified in time and sort of bagged like, and tagged rather like body bags with their vital statistics, types, dates, media and dimensions. Our intention instead was to transform this cultural material from what Foucault would describe as decontextualised traces of history into active agents. Now, we would work towards this by bringing them out of the dark into the light, if you like, and out of the past into the present through a new contemporary display and through reconnection with descendant communities. And it seemed more appropriate for me as an Indigenous curator to display the collection from a cultural perspective, to take more of a storytelling angle, more consistent with Indigenous practice. So the story of discovery started really on the 24th of May this year only. So this is what I saw. Descending the stairs into this vast and darkened spaces of the museum for the first time was like entering Aladdin's cave. It's a museum that had not fully functioned as a public exhibition space for 40 years, so it had a pervading sense of dormancy, of a sense of lives once lived, of dark passages, secret enclaves, empty showcases, and disused or abandoned structures. Think Dan Brown. A vast 7,500 square metres of space enveloped in darkness with shadowy figures peering out beneath plastic wherever you went. And that's the kind of... I should have shown you more. There's heaps of these around in the rest of the museum from the other places. However... On entering the collection storerooms within the museum, this dormancy was abruptly shafted by light and activity. There were the illuminated surfaces, wide surfaces of benches alive with objects under treatment, attended to by the buzz of white-clad conservators. And this, in fact, was the only sight of life, really, for four decades. And it was there that the treasures of Aladdin's cave were revealed. I found beautifully preserved objects lying dormant. It's another one of those funny ones. I know. I thought, oh, this is a late entry, but not. Yeah, these are personal kind of things that they're made for their papa, you know, it's rather than the more serious artifactual type. So, as I said, I found beautifully preserved objects like this lying dormant in their plastic wraps like cocoons awaiting their restoration, which is a bit of a loaded word, of course, in the context of the Vatican. I saw a few eyebrows lift amongst the cardinals in the front row. As each object was transported from the storage shelves out the back to the light in the inspection rooms, the object seemed to pass through a time warp, this past-to-present sense. As each object emerged from its cocoon of wrappings, there was an undeniable sense of rebirth. Gooseballs with ochre. Now, we drew breath when we saw exquisite markings engraved on wooden woomeras, finely woven human hair skirts, ceremonial skirts from the Pukumani ceremony, kulamans, lovely rustic, very large, some were like 2 metres tall. And that's like it was done yesterday. It's, you know, beautifully preserved. So the first encounter in the Vatican storerooms can be likened to a storeroom of tales, which is an expression coined by writer and mythographer Marina Warner in her book The Inner Eye Beyond the Visible in 1996. Now, she wrote of collection storerooms thus, and I quote, "A storeroom where stories lie waiting to be rediscovered, offering a new creative experience, not only for its own characters caught in its own plot lines, it offers magical metamorphosis to the one who opens the door, who passes on what was found in there, and to those who hear what the storyteller brings." I see myself in this context as the first of a new generation of storytellers, which includes, of course, the descendants of the makers of these objects. And the next chapter is only just beginning. What I found was, to some degree, what one would expect to find of Australian Aboriginal material culture of the late 1800s and early 1900s. There were tools for living, you know, assorted boomerangs, shields, spear makers, spear points, and again, ceremonial objects associated with the Pukumani ceremony from the Tiwi Islands or indeed from Kalumburu. So the collection comes mainly from communities at Kalumburu, which you can see up in the North Kimberley, the red areas from the Tiwi Islands at the top. You can see Melville there and Bathurst, and down near Perth around New Norcia, thus, of course, where they had the Benedictine mission since about the 1840s or 50s. So as beautifully crafted as the objects were, it was the unexpected and extraordinary that truly excited me. Here's a series of exquisite paintings with ochre on pieces of slate about the size of bread and butter plates. They're not only painted on one side, but most unusually on both sides. And it's entitled The Wanjana Song Cycle. Some showed dancers performing the krill krill ceremony with dance boards. And dancers today, you can see performing these ceremonies or similar ceremonies, including the string construction, the string construction ailments. And of course, Wanjana performances today, and note the images of the Wanjana on the wall at the back. Now, these images are ones I've used in the exhibitional presentations to you know, show ways of how this living culture persists, and particularly to international audiences who would not think so generally. Of course, Wangunas are the major creator beings that emerged from the sea and sky thousands of years ago in the Kimberley region, and they're associated with weather and, in particular, water. These are fascinating. Look at these four-figure ones. When I was giving this, again, to the Cardinals and others, Aboriginal Catholics, an interesting mix of people in the forum. You know, of course, I could see the other face in the rock. Can you see it, the car, just the face? And, of course, I made some flippant comment about the miracles of Mary MacKillop. Anyway, I survived. We're going to have a canonisation and a crucifixion in the same period. So this is one of the other ones, so the Wangunas slate with water and sort of cloud image. And how contemporary does that look? This is exactly what you'll see in a whole range of paintings from the Kimberley across the Western Desert today. Now, in a flight of fancy, I thought that the other side of the slates, which I couldn't see on this first visit, might have some reference to the other creator being of significance to Aboriginal Catholics, the Christian God, which would account for why they were painted on both sides. At least in my excitement, I believed this was feasible, but now that I've seen the other side, so as to speak, it'd be hard to substantiate materially, at least. However, this view cannot be entirely discounted, as Aboriginal Catholics have often chosen to represent the Christian God through the physical manifestation of symbols more common to their own creator beings. Given that this work, like all the others, was produced by individuals for their papa in Rome, then it is also not unreasonable to assume a degree of synchronisation that would lead one to see in the episodic nature of this Wangunas song cycle the episodic nature of the Stations of the Cross. Whilst there may only be 13 slates currently retrievable, the documentation strongly suggests that there were more, maybe 14 even. Regardless of the number of works produced, you know, whether it's 13, 14 or more, the meaning behind the stages of a song cycle and the Stations of the Cross have substantial conceptual parallels. That is, they both represent a devotional progression accompanied by images representing the events of a journey undertaken by a creator being. Now, the artist could just as easily paint a single Wangina figure as we see in this one on bark, which is how they're usually represented, but like the other ones, they are also painted both sides. You can see the mirror display at the back to show the other side. This is the first Wangina song cycle I've encountered. That doesn't mean they're not out there, but I haven't encountered any yet, so that's something to pursue. However, there seems to be good grounds for this assumption, that is the one relationship to the Stations of the Cross, when one considers this recent painting entitled God Was Working Through the Wangina, by Kimberley artist Margaret Mungulu. And she says that, and I quote, "Today we can come together as one. The faces in the blue, the Wangina, represents what God was doing through them. God gave them providence through the Wangina. God was working through the Wangina. Christianity is like a gift that was placed there through the Wangina." Unquote. Now, this element of inseparability, I believe, is built into this Wangina song cycle. Ian McIntosh, an anthropologist who worked with Aboriginal people on former missions in Arnhem Land over the past 3 to 4 decades, has observed that Aboriginal Christians pose the question, did God give Aboriginal people the dreaming, or did the dreaming give them God? Clearly, Aboriginal people for well over a century have had no difficulty whatsoever in seeing the universality of creation and fusing creator beings from different cultures, seeing them all as belonging to the one family and all related through the kinship system, as Margaret Mungulu suggests. This position is further reinforced when we take into account what we know about the artist of the Wangina song cycle. Photographed off a TV screen. Paul Muron, otherwise known as Big Paul, because he's, as you can see, very tall. He's well known as a devout practicing Catholic who appeared to live and work on the mission at what is now known as Clumberoo most of his life. He was a strong ceremonial leader and Catholic leader in his community. He was believed to be born at the late 1800s, which means he painted this, you know, as a mid-adult and a man with some status through his activities in the church. We found his records, which is really unusual. This is the only work that we found a name on. It was rare, as you know, in those days to actually record the names of individuals, and it was equally remarkable that we were able to locate his descendants. You know, such is the power of Aboriginal oral history telling. These works also have, a claim to being possibly the earliest existing Wanganas on portable surfaces in the world. Only later it became a practice to do them on small portable surfaces for ethnologists, and later they scaled up for the art market in the late 1970s and early 80s, such as this one by Alex Mingle Mangonul around 1979-1980. It's nearly 2 metres tall on bark. This one up on panel, and here's another one of his. And then I propose to do a Wangina exhibition in the vein of Emily down the track. And the next discovery of note was a second Wangina work on bark in mostly white with the red pigment traces of a Wangina image. You can see on its side, this is on the side. Now, here you can see it better. Viewed in the context of the Vatican, The ghostly tracings that remain on the surface remind one of the Shroud of Turin. Remnants of a second painting on the back evidently suggest a figure of Jesus. Now, I don't think that that one would think of the Shroud of Turin in the same kind of way if it wasn't kind of in the Vatican in that context. But the Father Papelli was urging me as strong as possible to actually call it the Shroud of the Wanderer. I was like, geez, I'd be crucified twice over if I did that. So well, we went as far as saying that it does. You can't help looking at it in that context and sort of thinking of shroud of some kind, the ghostly tracings. Now, my brief was quite vague, really, and quite late. I went there, I saw the collection. I think approach was made in about December, January. I saw the collection in May for a couple of days, and we opened on October the 15th. But I was here, not there. It was really just to kind of get some stuff out and fill a few showcases, really, but that's not how I usually do business. Now, the prime audiences for the Mappelli, you know, the one that he had to please in the first place was all the cardinals and the bosses in the Vatican, because they were, you know, sick of this young fella rabbiting on about opening this exhibition, opening this place after 4 decades, and they didn't give him much support either. So what were the curatorial issues, and, you know, how did I deal with them, you know, briefly? Well, I was confronted with a dark 1970s space, over-designed and over-engineered with a huge black metal box smack in the middle, 2 stories high. A collection of ethnographic objects that had been tucked away, as I said, for 40 years at least. I mean, they're there since the 1920s. Though beautifully preserved, there was next to no documentation retrievable at this time. The director was a field missionary, not a curator, no curatorial staff, bar one in the Asian area, and no exhibitions. The other 8 or so were restorers, as they're called, in a space, of course, that has not functioned as an exhibition space since the year it opened and closed in 1973. That is, there was no curatorial staff, no exhibition staff, and no publishing area for labels, and no infrastructure at all, really, as we know it. And the Vatican has contracts with a range of people and companies who are the only ones that can be used. So the label maker was really a showcase maker, and the showcase maker was really the flower getter, and so on. So yeah, the bureaucracy there is. I should be much more tolerant of it here now. The bureaucracy there is horrific. Like Father McPowley was saying, how, and he's a new kid on the block from the missionaries. That's not considered much of a high order, quite a low order. He said he had to get 10 signatures to get a computer and 2 more to get it turned on. And there's lots of stories like that. The first job then was to get them to paint grey concrete walls white. That's the part of that big box I spoke about in the middle, to get it white, get some light in there. Security guards and all were employed for the install. Next, in terms of the exhibition, what you saw was to people the spaces with images of Aboriginal people from today to show this dynamic, breathing culture. So I got huge images, covered all that box black, huge images white around it, and set up a bit of a contemporary art kind of a rhythm as well, exhibition as well as young people and old people. A lot of these images were taken from Heidi Smith's book on the Tiwi Islands. So this is sort of how it's looking now. And all around the top, like the top story of this box, it's sort of 2 floors high really, there's huge images of desert on one side, sea on the other, jungle on one, and an aerial view of serpentine rivers on the other. So here'd be the jungle at top left, and the and again we've got some Torres Strait Islander people as well, even though the collection is Aboriginal only. And in the same space, we're just joining us is some oceanic material, which sort of contextualise it in an international sense with sort of the Oceania concept, which is how they collected this material. But all underwent the treatment. So these steps, which not exactly these, but steps like these, turned into this. And so you can see the transformation that took place. This is as you walk down the steps on the right side, you can see the labels, Rituals of Life. You see they're not sort of museum-y, old world museum. It's very contemporary, white, stark, bold, graphic. But I used a lot of images rather than a lot of words to show how ceremonies and current day events associated with the objects, like under here, the Pukamani poles, which isn't where I want them. I want them right at front, but I lost that one. But you can see there. And I had these screens painted green behind them because they often look, if you go to the wrong colours with these things, they look like they belong in a shopping centre mall. They get very twee very quickly. And I didn't want to sanitise them by putting them against white either. So it's just these fine points. This is the Pukamani objects associated with the poles, which I put in black to give a more ritualistic feel. And again, contextualised with images. And old images from the time they were collected. Now, this is the Wandjina enclave. That was the Pukamani enclave, so I sorted into these enclaves because there's bits and pieces of collection all over the place. It's not any sort of collection policy in this case. So I made the Wandjina enclave or space here by having a very large blow-up of cave walls, people heavily populated with the Wandjina, so you can see instantly where they come from. That's the old display and... And this is a new one, which is, people by real people now. Ones you know even. Mr. Rudd, Mr. So this is the opening night, which is basically a media scrum. And that's you can see how I've put that as a sort of a relic, again, near its original source on rock walls. And all those sort of shields and things, they have a... You can see how I've made them into a contemporary display and used their form as to attract, you know, to engage people aesthetically and sensorially, and then there's lots of information, but I've got the labels flat on the case, so you don't see them before the objects. When you go to see the object, you see the information. And they, you know, they used a lot of acrylic, so you can't see the mounts. And there's a kind of talking labels. We had these community visits that were done with the Vatican and a museum rep were actually, and Catherine Agner, who works with me, went, and these are all filmed and used in the space. Now, the day before, or rather the day of the opening, we had this forum which Tim Fisher, the ambassador of the Holy See, organised, and I had the privilege, or not, whatever the case may be, sharing the stage with with Cardinal Pell. And it was, it's another story for another time, really, how extraordinary that forum was because of the eclectic mix of people in the audience. You hear me say a row of cardinals, a row of about 30 to 50 Aboriginal Catholics were over there, international media, theologians, all the best-heeled people of the Italian diplomatic circle and so on. So come question time, you're not talking to the usual mob, you know. So I gave the microphone often to the Aboriginal Catholics to answer a lot of the questions. And these are, again, people who don't see a distinction between Catholicism and Aboriginality. So has a lot of... It's quite intriguing for... Some get it and some don't, and one of them, a theologian, said, how come the Wandjinas, if it's a spiritual being, how come it's got no mouth? If it's got no mouth, how can you hear the word? You know, there's these sorts of questions, but it was said much more intelligently than that, but that's the guts of it. And one of the Aboriginal Catholic women got up, and there's no them and us here, don't forget, they're all Catholics. There's no white fella, black fella, yellow fella, none of that, right? They're all Catholics. So one of the women got up and basically said, well, the word had been spoken by the time the Wandjina was painted, so it didn't need a mouth. Or something to that effect. And then you see... and of course, and after that was the big opening, and rah, 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 we had... Minister Rudd and Bishop, there's Tim Fisher, and we have, as you can see, the gold and the Vatican colours and the Aboriginal floret in the front, and it was a total media scrum. And the restorers were sort of almost holding hands and circling the Wandjina case so nobody bumped it because it was like that, it was very scrummy. After the opening, there was this fabulous Aboriginal ceremony or performances up on these terraces. You just get this juxtaposition against these, you know, gold and ancient in Western terms. Just this, golden lit terrace of old buildings like this, and then you have, then you have, see, you know, all these blue are the Order of St. Josephine. Sitting on a Chinese rug and backlit by St. Peter's Basilica. All right, I better have more than that. And next day at the Vatican, of course, this is the canonisation day with 150,000 plus people. And we had a bit of a VIP. I was that close, like within, I said spitting distance of someone, they didn't like it. So I was within 20 metres of the Pope, and opposite us were sitting all these colourful characters in their cardinal outfits. So the pageantry and ritual was quite extraordinary. I took a book with me because I really thought I'd be bored after 4 or 5 hours of this, but no, I had too many photos to take. And I'll just finish with... a conclusion, of course. Now, the exhibit of Australian Indigenous material in the museum is, as you can see, much more than a display of interesting objects. It's a story of reconciliation and education. It's a story about the journey of Christianity through ethnography as well as a journey of Indigenous spirituality through Christianity. We see this whole new chapter of this century-old story being written, one that connects Kalumburu, the Tiwi Islands and New Norcia to Rome. And like a song cycle, the circle turns, now adding Canberra and the National Museum of Australia to its new trajectory. So this collection also provides a portal through which we can explore the complex impact of Catholicism in Aboriginal Australia and missions more broadly. The lost collection, lost to the source communities in Australia at least, is finding its way back digitally and orally at least, thus completing a 100-year-old circle. Okay, thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.